This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Well, I would like to welcome to the Sub 70 podcast, PGA Tour caddy for Kevin Na, Kenny Harms. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for taking the time today. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
Well, first off, congratulations on the victory at the Greenbrier. It has to be great to see, kind of, you know, to help get Kevin over that hump to get a second win on the PGA Tour. It's been a long time coming. And it has to be very satisfying to be on that team with him and kind of getting it over the finish line.
Oh yeah, for sure. It was a really, really great week. I think it was the most, calm I've ever seen him, in the 10 years that I've worked for him. You know, usually we got in that position and, you know, things didn't turn out as well as they should have, many of the times, but, you know, it's a learning experience. And, you know, we got off to such a great start on Sunday that you know, making the 30s and the 20s and the 40-footers, you know, in those first 10 holes kind of put him in a position where he was on cruise control.
Yeah, and I mean, looking at your guys' season and Kevin's season, it's been solid. He had a second at the Genesis earlier in the year. The mm-hmm. trend line's sort of been, you know, coming per se, also with his consistency he's had, let's just say, for the last decade. What was it about it this week that you think kind of got him over that hump? Is it more patience? Is there something different you guys are working on? Was there any other factors that sort of played into that performance he had on Sunday?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, everybody, you know, kind of looked at it and said, you know, Kevin was having a really good season. And to be honest, he actually wasn't. He really didn't start playing well until TPC. It was really smoke and mirrors. For the whole year, other than the second place, he tried to change some things in his swing in October and November, or actually, I should say November, December. And he also worked on getting a lot more speed through the hitting so he could hit the ball further. I think that, you know, when you take in all of them account, I think our, consistency went really, really kind of the opposite way of the way we wanted it to go. So, you know, he was really struggling in New Orleans. We were playing with Ben on in a team event, and we were playing a practice round. And you know, he just kept on missing greens with his irons, which he's normally never does. And he just decided at that time that, you know what, I'm going to go back to swinging the way that I used to swing in it. So you know, we showed signs of it turning around that week. The first day we actually played really poorly, and Ben played amazing. And then the second day we actually played really well, and Ben just hit a couple offline tee shots, and unfortunately we missed the cut, but you know, it gave him a week to really start working on his old golf swing back with his coach Drew Seckel, and the two of them got it going in the right direction. We got to TPC, and I think we made, I don't know if it was 21 birdies or 25 birdies for the week. Unfortunately we were still hitting bad shots, so we finished at 5 under par, but you know, the signs were there. And then we went to Dallas the following week and played really well. And his putter, you know, his putter started getting a little warmer. We finished sixth there. And then, you know, Colonial, we finished fourth. I think we had 62 on Thursday and then finished with a 61 on Sunday, which I think tied his course record. And obviously, you know, that was our third in a row, and then we went to Memorial, which he's had, you know, tremendous success. We lost in a playoff there to Matsuyama, I think 4 years prior, and was just, you know, tired from 4 weeks in a row. And usually we only play 3 weeks in a row, and he was 119th out of 120 in putting the first day. So, you know, we put ourselves behind the eight ball, but, you know, it was kind of a good wake-up call. We had a week off, and then we flew over to Korea. And, you know, the time change and different golf course, different green grasses, the way they set up the golf course is different. We finished fifth there. So, you know, we flew from there. We went over to D.C. and then he had jet lag. And he doesn't travel well. So for about 10 days, it literally took him 10 days of jet lag, of rest to get over the jet lag. And we made the cut at DC, but we went over to the Greenbrier and we stayed with some great friends of mine, Eva and Vince Mancuso. So Kevin stayed in the house with us. He had a great bed to sleep in, and literally he just rested the whole time. We took Monday off. Tuesday we went out. We just played 9 holes and practiced a lot on his putting. And started the first day off. We were actually doing pretty good, and then we faltered on 15 and 16. And I think we shot 1 under that day. But then all of a sudden, he found something that morning, and he was working on his putting, and we had a little bit of a rain delay, and he found something with his grip, and the rest is history. He has been hitting the ball really well, and all of a sudden, the ball, that hole looked like a basketball hoop, and everything's going in, and with the combination of the ball striking and putting, here we are talking about the win.
Is there a lesson in that, even like for amateur golfers? Like, all of us want to get better, but even the top professional golfers, at the level he's succeeded at for so long, trying to change the swing to get more distance. And is there a lesson in that sometimes you just have to go to the party with what you got, what's kept him as a very, very good professional for 10 years, and you have to just play to your strengths, and if you're not going to hit as far as Dustin Johnson, that's okay. You can still play the PGA Tour. He's long enough, and if he does what he does well, he can compete sort of at any type of venue.
Right, yeah. Obviously. I mean, you look at the players, in the past and the history that have tried to change their golf swings, and they went missing. You can look at so many guys that were hitting the ball left to right that started trying to hit the ball right to left. I mean,
I'm thinking like Martin Keimer.
That's what I was thinking about. To try and win the Masters, and he's a Hall of Fame player. He's got 2 wins and 2 majors. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame, the U.S. Open, the PGA, and then he disappeared, and now he's coming back. He doesn't really play over here anymore, other than the majors and the World Championships. Because when he came over here, he didn't perform well. He didn't have a card, so. Kevin, it was more of trying to change his golf swing to make it better, to be more consistent, and hit the ball a little further, but it was more about trying to get better. And that's what they all think. You look at Tiger Woods. I mean, Tiger Woods has changed his golf swing 3 times. Who knows how many majors he would have won or how many majors less he wouldn't have if he had tried it. But, he's the guy that maybe, if there's anybody that could do it, because it's not easy. I mean,
do you need his talent level, for lack of a better word, to make 3 different swings, win majors, right? I mean, that's an anomaly.
I mean,
it doesn't happen.
Yeah, in a way, the way that I kind of look at it is you look at these guys that changed equipment. Rory, it took him a year to figure out how to play a Nike golf ball in the equipment that he had. Patrick Reed, last year had a horrendous year, and he got a corporate sponsor with Nike, and he's playing any of the equipment he wants to play. Now he's a top 10 player in the world. So to go just to see how long it takes the players to adjust to equipment to try and change a golf swing, to me, it's crazy. I don't know. I think you just perfect what God gave you and what you've been working on your whole life. I mean, there's not that many players that have been able to change their golf swing that got better.
There's more roadkill from that idea than Nick Faldo emerging on the other side of it.
Right. Okay. I give it the 5% club. The 5% guys that have been actually successful in changing the golf swing. Yeah, maybe tweaking a little bit, but to change everything? No. It's suicide. So, he realized that it's his bread and butter, and you got to work with what God gave you, and that's what he's doing now. And the putter got hot, and I think he's always been a great putter, and it's kind of funny that the putter disappeared for a couple of years. So when he was striking the ball the best, his best 2 ball striking years ever were 15 and 16, and yet his putting stats are the worst that they've ever been. So it shows you how much emphasis that I believe that is putting. I think putting is everything. I mean, I know ball striking is important, but when it comes down to winning golf tournament, there isn't a player in the world that has ever won a golf tournament putting poorly. So
totally agree with you. Yeah, I mean, you can strike it, but you got to do what you got to have those runs like you guys had on Sunday morning. And my next question is sort of like from a caddy's perspective. So when you see your guy is out of the gate and he is on fire, and like you said, the golf hole looks like a basketball hoop.
Mm-hmm.
Do you stay out of the way? Do you encourage him? Do you say nothing? How does that sort of dynamic work when you can tell, for lack of a better word, your guy is just absolutely locked in and in the zone?
Well, I think it all works. It depends on who you're working for. You know, you have to be able to adjust to different players. It's not a player adjusts to his caddy. The caddy has to adjust to the player. The player is the one that's playing, and the caddy is the one that's caddying. So it depends on who you're working for. When I worked for Hale Irwin for 8 years, you know, I honestly didn't say anything to him, you know, other than talk to him. And, you know, when he wanted my input, he asked it. And every single year, because the first time I worked for him was in 01, and we were playing at Valencia. And we get to the eighth hole, and he's got 95 yards to the top of the ridge. It's been raining, so the greens are soft. He's got 95 to the top of the ridge, 100 to the hole. He pulls out sandwich. I'm going, it's a sandwich, 93 yards. I mean, literally, that's what it goes. It goes 93 yards in the air, and it doesn't go any further. So I just sat there, and he hit it, and hit the slope, and spun off the front of the green, and he three-putted, and he made both. So we got done, and we get done to the scoring tenor. I said, "Hey, Alex, can I ask you a question?" He says, "Yeah, what's up?" He says, "If I know you have the wrong club in your hand," he says, "let me rephrase that." I said, "If I think you have the wrong club in your hand, do you want me to say anything? Do you want me to say something?" And he says, you know, he felt like he stared at me for 5 minutes. It was probably about 10 seconds, but he's like, "When I want your input, I'll ask for it." So depending, if I'm working for Hale Irwin, I wasn't allowed to say anything. Now, there was ways of me being able to make sure I keep the bag there. I throw the wind up to get his attention.
Sure.
I said, I don't like the club. So that's what you do.
Right.
Now, going to, you know, who I worked for before Hale, Hubert Green, I got to stop him in the middle of his backswing if the wind had changed or if I thought that he didn't have the right club. You know, he gave me that, it's not control, but he gave me the ability to be able to stop to make sure, because I don't ever want Kevin to hit a club that's not the right club. The wind all of a sudden stops, and he's over his ball. I'm going to stop him. But with Hale, I couldn't do that. So you have to be able to adjust to certain players. And, you know, if a player wants a certain thing, you have to give it to him. And if he doesn't want you doing a certain thing, you don't do that thing. So, you know, it's all different. Kevin, you know, we know each other. I know him like, you know, I know him better than his parents know him. I know him better than his wife knows him. You know, I've been with him for 10 years. I've traveled with him for the first 5. It was me, him, and his agent. The three of us not roomed in the same, but we stayed in the same hotel every single week. I never had a rental car. I had to drive the courtesy car with them. I know Kevin like the back of my hand. So, you know, getting to Kevin, when Kevin is, we're just doing the same thing. I'm not going to change it up. Now, if he starts going the opposite way, then I'm going to say some things to get him back on track. But when a player is going, you know, like Kevin was, he's 5 or 6 under through 10, I think he was. Was he 5 under through 10? I don't know, wherever
yeah.
It was.
20, yeah, 5 under through.
Yeah, he was 5 under through, well, he was 5 under.
6 under, what, 6 under? He shoot 29 on the front, right?
He shot 29 on the front, so he's 6 under through 10.
Yeah.
We're going through the same thing. I mean, we got to the, you know, we're playing aggressive. We're attacking the golf course. You got to keep the pedal down. You got it. When you're playing well, you don't start playing defensive. So we got to the 11th hole, and he says, "You like three wood here?" I said, "No, I like driver." I said, he says, "Yeah, but, you know, three wood might get over the bunker, and it won't get to that right bunker." And I'm like, "Well, three wood will get to that right bunker if you hit it hard. It's just, you got to keep on going." Well, he hits a bad drive. We chipped out one at making bogey, but we continued to play aggressive. And you know, we didn't change anything. You know, we got to, you know, even on 17, you know, even I'm sure the commentators, when they pulled out a three wood out of the rough and he hit it straight, right. He hit a terrible shot, but he could have knocked it on the green, and he was trying to get to 21 under. He was going to try to birdie the last two holes. We were been playing aggressive. We were going to continue playing aggressive. Now, let's say we had a two-shot lead or a one-shot lead, there's no way in the world he'd have been hitting 3-wood. But because he had a five-shot lead, you know, there's nowhere he could have hit that where he was making double. And he wants to continue making birdies or have a chance of making an eagle and making it really exciting, you know, for TV and the fans and everybody. So we did something, and, you know, he hit a bad shot. There's not, I mean, he hit it 70 yards offline to where he hit it, and we wound up making par. But, you know, there's certain things. So, you know, and then we got to the 18th hole. We got a five-shot lead. He hits a great shot in there. And I said, dude, this is what it's all about. You know, and finally, it's like, you can enjoy this. This is the first time in his life on the PGA Tour that he could actually walk up the 18th hole, enjoy winning a golf tournament, and know that he's won it. So I just said, listen, dude, this is yours. And I sat back with Xander and Austin, his caddy, and just gave him the stage and let him do his thing because it's so hard to win on the PGA Tour. I mean, you look every week. How many times do you see a guy win by five? Doesn't happen.
It's rare.
Often. Very rare. Yeah. So, you know, I love that for him because, you know, he's worked so hard his whole life and, you know, and there it is. And so getting back to it, you don't really change unless it's going the opposite way. You know, if a guy starts struggling and he's got the lead, then you might need to say. But you need to say the right things, you know, to get him out or to get his mind off of where it is. And that's the most important thing, is if he's struggling and he starts making some bogeys, you got to get their mind off of what they're doing and get their mind on something else. You know, there's a lot of great caddies out there that will tell a joke or, you know, start talking about the great things in their life. But when a player is doing well and they're on cruise control, just keep on doing the same thing. You don't change a thing.
And, you know, I know you guys have been working together for a long time, and obviously it hit Twitter and everywhere else in the golf world where you guys had your back and forth this year at the Colonial, which I thought was awesome, just to see you guys kind of banter back and forth, and everyone knows he only hits it left and he holes it. So,
well, he actually didn't hit it left. He didn't hit it left. See, people don't realize where he actually hit it. He hit it.
Wasn't that left of the green?
No, he dropped it left of the green. He hit it. He flew it in the back bleachers.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I'm thinking of just the chip shot. I'm sorry.
You're right. Here's the scenario. If the ball just went over the green and he's up against the bleachers, he had to drop it back there, and he had nothing. But because it flew in the back bleachers and it was 10 yards or 7 yards into those bleachers, they had to make sure that he was still the same distance outside. So he was able to drop it all the way on the left side, and then he was chipping from the left side, and then he chipped it in and made birdie. So, you know, they never showed where the ball went. They just showed where we dropped it. So a lot of people like yourself thinking, oh, he was just left of the green. No, he actually flew it 30 yards over the green into the bleachers. So
when you guys have that back and forth, is that common, and you guys are just cool enough with each other that you're going to, I mean, because you were adamant, like, you didn't like the play. He's adamant, I can do it. I mean, he's the boss at the end of the day. He you know, he fires it. And like I said, it was a great moment, of course.
Yeah.
When he chips it in. But is that an anomaly for you guys to go like that? Or is that a fairly common thing where if there is a tough decision that you guys know each other well enough that you can go back and forth, it's all business, it's nothing personal, and then move on to the next hole and sort of that was it and that banter happened and nothing personal? Like, how does that translate? Because obviously you were pretty adamant on, like, you didn't like the play.
Well, I mean, yeah, okay. Let's put it this way. Let's put it this way. I said I love the play. And then he flies it 30 yards over the green and the bleachers. What kind of confidence is he going to have in me on the next time?
Exactly.
Okay, I don't ever agree with a player if I think they've got the wrong club. Ever. You know, unless I'm working for Hale Irwin and not allowed to say anything. But being with Hubert Green, he would say, I will open my mouth every single time and disagree with him. And the reason why he has so much faith, Kevin has so much faith in me, is because I am that way. I am that positive. It's a positive thing, not a negative thing, to disagree with your player. Because ultimately, you need to have the right club in their hand. And if you're not willing to be able to stand up to your player, then you're not a great caddy. I'm sorry. You know, great caddies aren't yes men. Great caddies are the ones that stand up to their player and make sure that they make the right decision. Now, there's going to be times where he's going to overrule me, and there's going to be times where I overrule him. And, you know, at that point, you know, I don't know why I walked away, to be honest, because I knew exactly where that ball was going. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter if it was a four iron. Like I said, I don't like either one of them. You know, I didn't like either one of them. And you didn't hear the first 30 seconds of the conversation. They didn't get it until about halfway through it. So it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, I was over by him, and then, you know, he pulls four iron, and then he goes, well, he goes, you like this? And I said, no, I don't like that. And then he comes in and he grabs the other one. I'm like, no, I don't like that. I don't like either one of them. I said, the play is to wedge it out and get it up and down. He's the best player inside of 100 yards on tour. The best.
So play to the strength, right?
Play to your strength. Play to the percentages. And he admitted, he made it on TV that it was the wrong play. But, you know, we were fortunate enough that we got away with it. And I say we because we are a team. And, you know, when he plays bad, we play bad. You know, it's not like, you hear, oh, yeah, he made a bogey on this hole. We made a birdie on that hole. I mean, no, we're a team. And we have an understanding and a respect. And, you know, and he knows that I'm a percentage player. He knows I am, you know, I don't like taking risks. I mean, unless the risk is worth the reward, I am, you know, Hale Irwin, 100%. I mean, there's the smartest guy I've ever been around that's played the game. His distance control, he never, I mean, and honestly, I told you about the one story where the sand wedge, that might have happened 5 times in 8 years. He didn't make mistakes.
Yeah. He didn't beat himself.
He didn't beat himself, right. I mean, and, you know, you see so many players beating themselves every single week on the PGA Tour. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I'm going to do everything in my possible powers not to let Kevin make mistakes. And unfortunately, we're human beings. We're going to make mistakes. I'm not saying that I haven't made mistakes, but, you know, I haven't made many in the 10 years I've worked for him. You know, if you play to the percentages, you're not going to make a mistake. You know, there's going to be some times where the ball is going to come out of the rough and fly more than it is, or come out a little dead more than it is. You might guess wrong, but if you play to the percentage, you're going to give yourself the greatest opportunity to win.
And with your years of experience at doing this at a high level, that's just the belief system that you've seen from experience that more often than not, that works more, as good as those guys are with wedging and putting, than it is trying the miracle shot.
Right. And, you know, and Kevin, I mean, unfortunately, Kevin likes the miracle shot. The funny thing is, I don't get it sometimes, but he'll challenge a par three with a 3 iron in his hand, but he'll be scared with a pitching wedge. Not scared, but a little more defensive with a pitching wedge in his hand when a pin is 4 off the back. I mean, you know, it just, sometimes it just doesn't make sense. It is what it is. You know, I've been fortunate enough to be around some of the greatest players that ever play the game. And when, you know, the first year I caddied on tour, on the ladies tour, I wasn't out there to caddy. I was out there to see the world, to have fun, to enjoy life. And it wasn't until that next year that I decided that, hey, I'm going to do this for a living. I'm not going to go back to being an assistant pro. I'm going to do this for a living, that I took it serious. And I really started pay attention and watch the greatest players play. And, you know, and on the ladies tour, it was watching Julie Inkster and Patty Sheehan and Pat Bradley and Nancy Lopez and Jan Stevenson and, you know, Annika. Not that I was around Annika, but, you know, when I was married to Emily, watching her. But then when I got to the PGA Tour to be able to, my first job being with Hubert Green, who's a Hall of Famer, then Hale Irwin, who's a Hall of Famer. I got to work for Gary Player for a week, Lee Trevino, Raymond Floyd for 5 or 6 weeks. And I'm around at the Skins games with Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, Arnold Palmer. I mean, all I did was, it was like I was a sponge. I was learning everything I could from these people because they were the greatest players in the game at that time. Now it's, you know, it's a different game than it was then. You know, back then the balls would spin and you couldn't swing at a club at 150 miles an hour because the ball wouldn't stay on the planet. But now the equipment is to go so far and hit it high, and, you know, the game has evolved and changed. So you have to adjust with that as well. So I'm always learning. It's like my dad always said to me, you know, growing up, he said, I don't care if you're a garbage man, you be the best damn garbage man you can be. So I always taken that philosophy in caddying. So I'm always trying to get better.
How did you start working for Kevin? How did that come about? Back in 2009, I believe, is when you guys started. So how did that team kind of come together?
I started working for him full time in 2009. I actually met him. I was supposed to work an off week because I always would try to come out here when I was working for Hale just to keep my face out for Garrett Willis in the Canadian Open in 2008. And I got up there thinking that he was in the tournament. He told me he was in. He was 11th alternate. So my friend Steve Hulka, who used to carry a Champions Tour, carries on the PGA Tour, back in the PGA Tour. He also has the equipment trailer that goes, brings all the equipment, you know, the players' luggage and stuff like that from tournament to tournament. He was trying to get me Kevin's buddy, who was the number one Canadian tour leader that was going to get a sponsor invite. But Kevin's caddies couldn't, I think his grandmother passed away or something, so he didn't have a caddy, so Kevin took me. And we want to finish in eighth that week, and about 6 weeks later, he called me up and offered me the job, and I turned him down because I was working for Hale Irwin. And he said, "Oh, okay, and you know, I'll give you a call in a couple of weeks." I said, "Yeah, if you ever need anybody and you get stuck, just let me know. If I get off week, I'll come out and work for you." So he called me literally like 5 minutes later and said, "Hey, listen, fired my caddy. I says I'd like you to work all your off weeks from Hale." I said, "All right, let's go over the schedule." So we went over the schedule. I worked for him in Mississippi. A buddy of mine was getting married the week that used to work for Raymond, the week of the tournament up in Syracuse. So, and I told him, I said, "Listen, I can work it, but I'm going to leave Friday and I'll come back Sunday." He says, "Okay, perfect." So we're playing. I think we're in like 13th or 15th place when I left. There was a rain delay, so he still had like three holes to go. So I left Friday. I came back. We're in 52nd place, I think. We played on Sunday. I don't know. We shot even par one under. He says, "Hey, can I talk to you?" So we went out to the parking lot, and his dad was there. And he says, "You know, I really want you to come and work for me full time." And I said, "Kev, I said, you know, why don't you think about things for a couple weeks?" He says, "You know, you really need to figure out what you want to do." I said, "His nickname, you know, he had a nickname of the apprentice out there because he fired so many caddies." Well, I've never been fired once in all the years I've been caddying. And that was a concern of mine. And I just said to him, I said, "Listen," I said, "why don't you think about things, and I'll see you in Vegas." And he says, "All right, well, we'll go to dinner." So I get to Vegas, and we wound up going to dinner. We went to this Korean barbecue place right around the corner from the MGM where I was staying, and we were there for 4 hours. It was the longest dinner of my life. But we had everything. I could not believe the amount of food these Koreans eat. I mean, it was unbelievable. And the food was awesome. So anyway, 2 hours into the food, they said, "All right, we need to talk about next year." So they made me, just make it short, they made me an offer that I couldn't refuse. And it was very difficult for me to leave Hale. But, you know, I believed in Kevin a lot after working for him. I actually, you know, it's a funny thing. We were walking off. We had just three putted the last hole for par at the Canadian Open. And I said to his dad, I said, "You know, you don't have to worry about your son. I really believe this kid's going to win some majors. He's that good." And now here we are talking in a Korean restaurant in Las Vegas about me going to work for him. But they made me an offer that I had to leave Hale and come work for Kevin. And, you know, it was difficult. Every single time I've left a player, it's been difficult. But leaving Hebert and then leaving Hale were probably two of the most difficult decisions that I ever made in my life. But they turned out to be the right ones.
Was it tough to leave Hale Irwin? I mean, it had to be, right? Oh, yeah. I mean, he's got to be such a classic. Yeah, yeah. He was still playing great at that period of time. He was still competitive.
He was competitive, but he was, you know, he was getting older. He was 63. You know, I'll tell you a little story about, you know, because when Hale called me, you know, I told Hale, I said, "Listen, I got to talk to Hubert, because Hubert's been like, you know, a best friend to me." You know, I'm not going to say, he treated me like I was his son, but he treated me like a best friend as well. It was really hard for me to leave. But anyway, I talked to Hubert, and you know what Hubert said to me? I said, "Hubert, I got a problem." And he goes, "What's the problem?" And he goes, I said, "Well, Hale Irwin called me." He says, "Kenny, If you don't take the job, you're fired. You have to take that job. He's the best player on tour. You're married. You're going to have a family. You got to take care of yourself. So that shows you the caliber of human being that Hubert, I mean, the caliber of Hubert, the human being that Hubert is. Now, fast forward to having to leave Hale, just as difficult. I mean, because, you know, we were close. I mean, we'd go to dinner together. You know, I was very a part of his family. I was really good friends with Becky and Steve, his daughter and son, and loved Sally to death and his wife. And, you know, it was a tough choice. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, Hale was 63 and then he's going to be 64 and he's going to be 65. And, you know, the opportunity was there. And so I made that this choice then to accept the job. And you know, I worked for Kevin and Steve at the father son. And they came over to the house and I told Steve and I said, do you think I should tell him now or tell him at the end of the week? Because I'm thinking the end of the week. He says, no, just tell me at the end of the week after it's over because, you know, it's going to be tough. I mean, it's you know, as hard as it is for a player to fire a caddy, it's just as hard for a caddy to leave a player. It's not easy, especially when you've been with somebody for 8 years. There's a relationship there. There's a friendship there. You know, you're spending more time with that player than their wives are, you know, when you're on the road. It's difficult. So, you know, and Hale texted me yesterday, you know, congratulating me and Kevin and passing it on. And, you know, the friendship's still there. And, I try to get out there for the father-son if I'm in the town in Orlando. And so, you know, I've been blessed to have great friendships and, you know, so here we are, you know, 10 years later. And, you know, Kevin's got a second win, and hopefully we're off to maybe, you know, at 34, maybe a Hall of Fame career, hopefully, because he definitely has the talent.
So here's what I think about Kevin from a fan's perspective. I don't know if you see this when you're out there with him, but he has to have like a cultish sort of following. Like, I, even before this win where I started doing podcasts, I love Kevin Na because, like, he seems real. Like, when he was struggling to pull the trigger, you know, we've all had that, you know, demon in your head that you can't do it. If you play golf and you love golf, you go through good spots and bad spots. He seems genuine. You know, do you see that when the fans come up to you guys too, that people like this guy because he is real and he's not playing like a robot and he's, you know, if it's a great shot, he'll tell you. If it's a bad shot, he just sort of deals with it and he'll make fun of himself a little bit. Like, I think he has some qualities that golf fans admire and like. And I like watching him play. And he seems like a really, he wears it on his sleeve. He's a real guy. Do you get that perspective from people coming up talking to you guys that they feel like they can go talk to him because they almost feel like they know him from watching him on, you know, TV for so long? Okay, so is my perspective sort of correct on that?
Yeah. I think what you're saying has so much truth to it. You know, everything that he's gone through, you know, the time when he made the 16 at San Antonio, I think this is when people really started to lean towards him and watch him and become him. Because when he came out of those trees, he had this huge smile on his face. Here I am. I'm pissed off at the world where we were 4 under for the rest of the holes when we make the 16. But he's got this smile on his face, you know, and that went viral.
No doubt.
And the fans he got from that. And then you go and you fast forward to the whole problem where he couldn't pull the trigger. And he was in the slow play. And he was honest for the first time. A player comes out and says, yes, I am slow. I have a problem and I'm going to fix it. And for the first time, you see a player put the game of golf in front of his own career.
Exactly.
Because let me tell you something. When you change from being a slow player to trying to speed everything up, you look at his career for the next 4 months, he played terrible. But you know what? He sped up, and he's now not one of the slowest players on tour. He's not even a slow player. He's deliberate on the greens, but everybody's deliberate on the green. But because of that stigmatism is still there, everybody still thinks he's slow. And then the whole thing with the idiots in the crowd pull the trigger and this and that, I'll let them get away with it once or twice, but if they keep it going, they're going to deal with me. And you don't want to deal with me. There's a respect. There's a level that you can get to, but you got to respect players. You got to respect the game. But with that being said, he has if you look at the players in the last 7 years, I guarantee you that he has the highest percentage of fans in the last 7 years than any other player on tour.
Like people did, like they like him, right? Like I feel like I could walk up to him and like have a conversation for 5 or 10 minutes, and he would be totally cool. Right. Like that's the sense you get of Kevin Na.
Right, exactly, and you know he's really matured into a player, and I said this to him. I said, dude, you're one of you're ranked. You know, he was like 80th in the world, but you have more followers than, you know, not Ricky or any of the superstars, but you take away the superstars and Kevin is one of the most followed players on tour. You know, he got to the game late with Instagram and stuff like that. He's only really on Instagram. We got rid of Twitter. There's too many idiots on Twitter and all they do is they sit on the computer and try to pick fights. So we got rid of Twitter and, you know, just focus on the positive. There's no reason to be, you know, back and forth with these people on Twitter. So, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of good people on Twitter, but, you know, Instagram is more his, and I think he's got, you know, I bet you, and just because in the last three days, I guarantee you he probably got somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 more followers and probably 20,000 or 30,000 more fans. You know, because you look at, you know, I went back and I saw some of the highlights. I haven't seen the telecast, but, you know, the smile that he has on his face, he's endearing. I mean, he brings people towards him, which, you know, he never used to do when I first started working for him. You know, he's changed, he's matured, he enjoys the game, I think.
I mean, maybe that's it, right? Like, it doesn't look like he's going through hell in a handbasket out there. Like, it looks like he's having fun. Like, you know, he was joking, didn't he buy a visor this year or something at the Players' Championship in the Pro Shop and, like, thanked it for his discount?
The greatest of all time. The greatest of all time, Jack Nicklaus. Hey, don't get me wrong, he's the greatest of all time, Jack Nicklaus. I mean, he's wearing this goat, I'm like, that is awesome. I said, you got to continue wearing it. And then he started wearing the So High, Southern Highlands, golf club. He's wearing that now. They sent him, they asked him, he says, yeah, I'll wear it until, you know, he gets another sponsor. And
sure.
I'll tell you what, the sponsors are going to be beating down his door for goods. This kid is, I think he's finally getting to where he has got the confidence and the calmness, you know, and I'm hoping that it continues. And you know, I think the real, you're going to see the greatest golf out of Kevin on the future, hopefully.
So with your career, how did you get started being a professional caddy? I know you just mentioned you were an assistant golf professional, but how did you, you know, make, I know you said your first year just trying to travel and seeing the world, but how did that step even happen where you're like, okay, I'm going to go out there and do this for a year and let's see where it kind of takes me. How did that transpire? How did you get involved in golf at sort of that level?
Yeah, it was in 1990, graduated from Westchester University, and I was like the 6th, 7th man on the golf team there. I was a wrestler my whole life, and I fell in love with the game of golf when I went to school in North Carolina. My first year of college, there was a guy on the golf team and I would go out there and practice with him and play with him. And I wasn't any good. I mean, I was, you know, I played once a year with my dad shooting 120. And I went to Westchester. Long story short, I wound up going to Westchester University and we practiced at a club called White Manor. And I would try to caddy there on Saturdays and Sundays to make some extra money, you know, being in college. So one of the members there, his name was Les Kaplan. He owned Philadelphia Outdoor. He took a liking to me, and he said to me, he says, I want you to be an assistant pro here, and if you don't like it after you can come and work for me. So I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. So I wound up working on my game like 3 or 4 hours a day, and I got down to a +1, and I was shooting 83 in college my senior year. I mean, I was the 6th man. I mean, I wasn't any good. And I just, you know, no more school. I had all this free time. So Les got me a job at the Palm Beach Polo Club for the winter. Well, I get the flu the week of Thanksgiving. I was supposed to be down there that Monday or that Tuesday. Well, Sunday, I've got the flu. My mom's not going to let me leave the house and drive down and start working. So I was in bed for a week, and I didn't want to ever get sick. So you know, everything happens for a reason. I'm a firm believer in that. I get down there and I don't have a job. They're going to let me wash cars. And I'm like, no, thank you. I'll find another job. So I got on the phone book and I started calling every club in South Florida. There were no jobs. So I saw a billboard on the side of the highway for the Sovali Classic. It was a PGA Tour event, team event. And I didn't even know it had amateurs in it. You know, amateurs play with the pros. So I'll just go there. And, you know, being naive and young kid, I'm like, I'll just go grab one of the pros and I'll caddy for him. Obviously, I didn't get a pro. I wanted to caddy for one of the amateurs. And I met a guy named John Venn. And his nickname was Rocky. And Rocky played at Bergen Community College, which I transferred into after North Carolina and going to Glassboro State. I found a new love of my life, and I didn't want to be away from her. So I went home to go to JUCO to wrestle, to be honest. And I got, you know, I went to the Nationals in wrestling, and I had a full ride to Fairleigh Dickinson, but it's a long story. But I wound up going to Westchester. And anyway, Rocky played golf at Bergen Community College, and I wound up playing golf there too. So I heard about this Rocky character my whole life from my coach, Doug Yenny. Well, I run into him. Well, I needed a place to stay, so I stayed with him for the week on the floor in his hotel room. He gave me a pillow and a blanket, and I slept on the floor. And then we wound up getting a place together, and we wound up caddying at this club called Boca Rio. And times were tough, man. I was making $50 for a loop, and I was only getting out three or four times a week. So I was living on $150 to $200. After the second week, I called up my dad and said, I'm coming home. I said, I'm not doing this. I'm going to come home. And you know what he said to me? He says, no, you're not. You're going to figure this out. I said, this is a real job. You're not coming home. So I called up my mom. You know, my parents are divorced. So I was like, I'm going to go move in with my mom. And my mom was like, well, what'd your dad say? And he said, well, I can't go against your dad. You need to stay down there. So I did. And, you know, the LPGA and the Champions Tour started up. So we went over to Key Biscayne. And, you know, Rocky couldn't get a job there. So then we drove over to Wellington for where the women were. And he got Marlene Floyd, and I'm sitting in the parking lot, and I didn't get a job. So I worked both pro-ams, and I was sitting on the putting green on Saturday, and I ran into a lady named Lynn Connolly, and she had forgot to sign up that week. And somebody told me, you know, after she walked away, they're like, go ask her. There's nobody wants to work for her. She's not very good, but at least it's a job. I'm like, so I ran to the parking lot and I caught her. And that was before the cell phone. So she said, oh, I got an older guy. I said, but you know, let me see what I can do. Here's my phone number. Call me on Monday. So I called her and she says, you're caddying. Well, fast forward, we're on like the 15th hole on Sunday, and we're leading the golf tournament, or we're one shot behind. I forget what we're, but we wound up choking, and we finished eighth, I think, or sixth. And she says to me, you want to go to Hawaii for 2 weeks? And I said, yeah, I would love to. What's after Hawaii? And she goes, San Diego. I said, can I do that one too? And she says, yeah. Well, we go to Hawaii. We make both cuts. We go to San Diego. We finish second to Laura Davies. So I get a check from her for the week for like $2,600. So I call up my dad and said, Dad, I just got a check for $2,600 and I'm making $350 as an assistant pro. He says, Kenny, just, you know, he says, why don't you just do this for a year? Go see the country. Go see the world. I said, you can always come back to being an assistant pro. So that's how it started. So thanks to John Venn, a.k.a. Rocky, who I actually wound up getting to a caddy for Hale when I left, and we're good friends to this day, and that's kind of how it all started.
And the rest is history, right?
And the rest is history.
Well, we touched on this earlier, and you really have, you know, you've got some Hall of Famers that you worked with. So even though I know you've talked about them a little bit, I'm just going to throw the names out there in like quick 20, 30 seconds of what comes to your mind when I say each guy, of what maybe you admired about him or what made him great, or, you know, just what you sort of, what about them that you enjoyed working with them or their best attributes. I'm just going to throw them out there and just kind of let me know what you think, if that's all right. Obviously very tough because he just passed away, but what a career. Hubert Greene.
He was one of my best friends until the day he died. I'm just going to tell you a quick story about Hubert. You know, I already told you, you know, when Hale came to me, it just shows you the character of him. He put everybody in front of himself. You know, he wanted the best for me. When Hubert came, or Hale came to me, you know, he said I had to take the job, he was going to fire me. So he was a best friend, tremendous competitor, probably, you know, one of the top five short games, probably one of the top three chippers of all time, Hall of Famer. Best friend, crushed when he passed away, you know, texted me 2 days before he passed, and he'll be with me. He was with me on the 8th. He was with me all last week. I even actually said to Kevin, I said, somebody, when Kevin knocked a shot in onto the 18th green, I said, somebody up there is looking at us with a big old smile on his face. And even Kevin's like, he were green, because he meant the world to me. He loved Kevin. He was always texting me, what's going on with Kevin? Why is he doing this? Why is he doing that? So, you know, he's just an amazing man, amazing human being. He will be missed for a long time. Golf lost a gentleman. That's about all I can say about that.
Yeah, and like everyone I've ever talked to, like, who's been around Hubert Green said the same thing. Like, just class, right? Just class.
Yeah.
The nickname
the Doberman, but he had no bite. That was just the front. If you were any part of his life, he put you in front of him. It's just class. Hale Irwin, probably the fiercest competitor I've ever seen. Hated to lose. Brilliant. Best course management I've ever seen. Learned so much from him on, you know, managing a golf course, the way you play a golf course. Amazing human being, fantastic father, husband, probably, you know, if there was a weakness in his game, it was probably his wedge play. But other than that, everything was just phenomenal. Yeah, great friend again, another great friend. Texted me yesterday, congratulating me and making sure that I told Kevin, say congratulations to him as well.
Lee Trevino.
Oh, I love being around Lee. I wish I got to work for him more. Probably one of the greatest shot makers of all time. I worked for him 1 week after he had the rollers put in his back from Germany. He couldn't get out of, off the couch for 6 months. And loved the game. Nobody talked more than him. Second probably was Fuzzy Zeller. You know, I think he probably would have went down as probably one of the top 10 players of all time if he hadn't gotten hit by lightning. You know, he took a one guy that had Jack's number. So to me, he was, you know, I wish I could have worked for him more and been around him more. Love the guy to death.
How good was his wedge play? His action with a wedge, even from that 60, 70, 80, 90-yard shot, I love that action through the golf ball. Was it something to see in person of how damn good he was with wedges and shot creation with those clubs?
Oh, it was unbelievable. And, you know, back then, you had to spin the ball and control the golf ball. It's a totally different game today. Today, it's a ball that doesn't work, a ball that's designed to go high. The equipment's designed to fly. It's a totally different game. Unfortunately, we don't get to see many of those shot makers anymore. Even the time that he came back, you know, from the surgery of having, and it was the first time he played after that. I was, you know, Hale wasn't playing in Baltimore, and I got to work for him. And the shots that he was hitting, and, you know, he hadn't practiced in probably 6 months. You know, he couldn't get off the couch. So, and he was still hitting these little wedge shots that, you know, would start 15 yards right of the green and hook into the hole. I mean, just brilliant. Yeah, one of the greatest workers of the golf ball ever. And probably one of the greatest players of the game ever. Unfortunately, like I said, he got hit with lightning and, you know, kind of dampened his career. But he was the only guy that had Jack's number.
Gary Player.
Amazing human being. You know, nobody traveled more than Gary. You know, his career stands. I mean, he's won, what, 150 tournaments around the world. I believe he's got more wins than anybody else worldwide. Unbelievable ambassador of the game. You know, very proud to be able to, be able to work for him. I was supposed to work for him in the Masters, and I forget what year it was. I think it was 2003 or 4. He had promised me the Masters, and he came up to me that year, and I'll remember this day forever. Came up to me in Naples, and he says, "You know, I got some really bad news." And I said to him, "So what's the matter?" He says, "Yeah, you can't caddy in the Masters, but I promise you, I will give you another tournament." And he says, "Yeah," he says, "this the richest guy from South Africa, I forget his name, was going to donate $10,000 to his children's school that he has there for the Masters and $10,000 for the British Open." And I don't know why, but I just said, "That's too bad, Gary. I would have given you $20,000." And he sat there and he looked at me and I said, "No, I'm just kidding. I don't have that kind of money." But, you know, he lived up to it. He came up to me and I wound up working for him in Destin, Florida. And, you know, he was kind enough to write on the bib, "Best caddy he's ever had." And I know that he just wrote that just to write it, but that's the kind of class he had.
Aaron Baddeley.
Oh, God, I love that guy. I learned a lot from him by caddying for him for, you know, the 3 weeks that I worked for him. I was fortunate enough, the blessings to be able to work for him the week he won. He gave the Easter sermon. You know, I got up at 6 in the morning, sunrise sermon that day, you know, when he's going in trying to win a golf tournament. Very religious. You will never hear anything from anyone ever say anything bad about Aaron Baddeley. You know, and he's probably one of the top three guys I pull for on tour.
And that putting stroke, man, I like that putting stroke. That
let's get to the imagination of this guy's short game. It's phenomenal. I don't think he's as good as Kevin around the green, but he's up there. His imagination is unbelievable. And you know, I was very blessed to be able to work for him two more tournaments, the British Open and the Canadian after that. But yeah, phenomenal. Very talented around the greens. Probably one of the best putters on tour.
Well, I've just got a few more for you here, and they're sort of just your perspective of being out there and whatnot. So who are some of the best guys, players on the PGA Tour from a personality standpoint that if you guys were in a group, you would love to have, say, these two or three other guys with you? Or if you're playing threesomes, two other guys that are just positive fun, that the vibe between you and Kevin and those other players and caddies would be a blast?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one because I don't want to single anybody out and then leave people out because there's so many great guys. I mean, there aren't many guys that, you know, I would be like, "Oh, God," you look at your pairing and you go, "Oh, I'm stuck with this guy." There really aren't that many out there anymore. You know, I'll say one because I'm a huge, you know, I rate courses for Golf Digest. I love playing with Johnson Wagner. He's a great guy. We were fortunate enough to play with him and his caddy, Matt, another great guy just this last week on Thursday and Friday. And, you know, we every time we're together, we talk about golf courses we played. And we're huge, both Seth Rainer, C.B. McDonald fans, so we talked about them. Obviously, you know, Old White is a C.B. McDonald, Seth Rainer. Up there, who else? James Hahn is always fun to be around. Harold Varner, I love being around Harold. Harold's got a great sense of humor. Classy player. I think he's going to come into his own soon. He's getting up there. Gosh, who else? You put me on the spot here. You know, I always love being around Aaron Baddeley too. You know, just the positiveness and you know, the value of him with his beliefs and the religion and everything else. You know, so everybody's got their own little thing. But if I was going to pick three, and I'm going to leave people out, and I know I'm going to get off the phone with you going, saying, "Oh, God, I wish I had said this guy and that guy and that guy," because there's so many guys. Ricky Fowler, I love being around. You know, it just, everybody's got a different character to them or a different thing that I like about them. You know, the competitiveness of Jordan Spieth. Watching, you know, I've never been paired with Tiger Woods, but we're going to play a practice round with him on Monday of the PGA for the first time.
How cool.
You know, I love the way that Tiger is now, you know, but yeah. I'm the old Tiger because I really wasn't out here and I never got to be paired with him, but he's so personal now. He's you know,
he looks like he's enjoying it. It looks like he's enjoying the journey versus just from the outside looking in versus looking like, yeah, it's greatness, I get it, but stay the blank out of my way. Like, looks like there's a joy in what he's doing. That's what I see.
There is, and I think he's got a great match in Joe LaCava. I think he brings a lot to that relationship. Joe's a great guy, loves his sports. We got, you know, we're both Yankees and Giants fans, and you know, I've been, it's one thing I've always said to Kevin, so when are we going to play with Tiger Woods? Come on, man, let's go. And then we started playing good and he gets hurt. So, you know, we're finally, you know, and Tiger texted Kevin on Sunday. So, you know, hopefully we'll get to spend more time with him and get to know him and be around him and get to watch him play, which, you know, that's one thing that I love is getting to watch the best players play. So, you know, whether it's Rory, you know, Bubba, I think Bubba's probably – I love being around Bubba. I mean, I got to set something straight because Bubba's got a bad rap. You know, Bubba's been pretty tough on his caddy.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, right? The guys who love golf, when he would bark at Teddy, it's like, whoa. Like,
But that's inside the ropes. The guy has the biggest heart. He does more. He does so much for charity. You know, he was sitting there on the 18th green when we got done. Being around, he likes to joke around. He's actually got a tremendous personality. It's just that when he's in, you know, in game mode, just, you know, no different than Hale Irwin. I mean, you know, Hale Irwin was a fierce competitor. He didn't joke. He's not one of the guys you wanted to be paired with because he wanted to crush you. Now, Bubba has a different mentality when it comes to that, but the guy is misunderstood. He's he'd be one of them. So there's guys that I would say and you'd be like, no, there's no way. But you know what? I'd love to be paired with Bubba. I love playing practice rounds with Bubba. And there's a reason why Ted Scott's still working for him because he is a fine human being. So you know, I am going to leave people out, but you know, being paired with somebody because of their shot making and being able to pair, you know, learn something from Phil Mickelson's short game or, you know, in awe of the shots that he hits. I mean, so I can't give you three. I'm sorry. I'm going to give you 100.
Yeah, no, well, it's a pretty good list. It's an interesting perspective because you're out there, right? I mean, you really know the guys. Right. I just get to see the outside snippets of it where you're there, right? You get to, I mean, it's an interesting perspective. No, I was going to ask you, I don't have this in my outline, but we're speaking the same language. Seth Rayner and C.B. McDonald are by far, I love their architecture over anybody else that's ever built a golf course. So I have to ask you, like, of the ones you've played, and if you're doing the rating, what's in your top two or three or four Rayner, McDonald, or just Rayner golf courses that you've just absolutely fallen in love with? I'll see if you're on the same list I have in my head here.
I'll just tell you, number one is Chicago Golf Club.
Oh, yeah, it's so good. It's so
good. And it's, you know, everybody says Steve McDonald, but Seth Rayner redid the whole golf course. And the women, the senior women's open there is this week, and it's going to be just phenomenal. I am so happy to see that they're getting to play and getting on that stage, and they're going to be the first ones. And I think that's really cool. I think, you know, I'm so happy that Chicago Golf Club did that. I've known a couple members there. One of them's son's playing on the Chinese PGA Tour. I had him down here with a buddy of mine, Ducey. And so Chicago Golf would be one. Fisher's Island would be two, hands down. Number three would be Shore Acres, hands down. Number four would be probably Camargo Club. Number five. Now, I haven't played Yale, so I haven't played
that
yet.
That's awesome. Yeah, I heard it's fantastic.
Played Yale. Then you're going to go to Yeaman's Hall, which is probably the biggest sleeper of all of them.
I love Yeaman's Hall Club. Oh, Yeaman's is awesome.
I've almost awesome. I haven't done the redesign yet, so I need to get up there. Then Mountain Lake is phenomenal in Florida here. Yeah. I think it's probably it is the biggest sleeper because nobody can get out there. We were fortunate enough. You know, I've been a member at Lake Nona for 20-something years. I got the membership on hold right now, but our manager here was our old manager was friends with the old manager there, unfortunately, that just passed away. So I've been down there a handful of times. It's probably my favorite golf course in Florida. What other ones? I played Fairfield Country Club. It's good, but it's not, it doesn't have a lot of the, you know, it's got a Redan, but it's a weak Redan. It doesn't have a Barrett. It doesn't have a lot of the characteristics. They changed it over the years, unfortunately. The one in Monterey Peninsula is a Seth Rayner, but it's been butchered. You wouldn't even know he's been there. And they just did a redesign there, which I heard it didn't go back to its original, but it's supposedly really good now. So looking forward to getting there. Where else? What other Seth Rayners am I forgetting? Oh, gosh. He was a part of National. Obviously, CB McDonald's got credit for that. He was a part of the Creek Club. The sister club to the Creek Club, which is just redone. It is awesome.
Have you played National?
I have played National. I played National.
Phenomenal.
It's phenomenal. I mean, that would be probably two, but or three behind. It'd probably be two. I mean, National was probably the most fun I've ever had playing a golf course, and it was 20 years ago, and I still remember it. That's how good it was and how quirky it is, and I love quirkiness. I mean, I hate to say it, but Old White is phenomenal. That's in my top 10. That's a top 100 golf course, and it's not in the top 100. There's so many good ones. There's so many characteristics. They're just so much fun to play.
Yeah, I don't know what it was in the – yeah, how did he do that? I mean, how did – you think like something that old, you know, they would have just made it better. But there's something about the feel or the bunkering or there is just something magical about what Seth Rayner –
magical.
Yeah, that it's it can't be replicated. You can just feel it. Like, you know, when I've been fortunate enough to play Chicago a bunch of times and Shore Acres, I'm outside Chicago. And, when I go to Charleston every year, I play Yeamans, and you can tell it's not replicated, right? Like, you can tell it's the real deal. And I don't know why anybody else doesn't have that feel, but there's something about that man's design and his work that still holds up the test of time that is fantastic.
Yeah, the week of PGA, I'm going to go over and play St. Louis Country Club again. It is phenomenal. I mean, I can just go on and on and on about everything. I haven't played a bad one. You know, you go to some Donald Ross's and it's like, he did so many of them. I mean, how many did he really do? Who knows? But there's a characteristics, the bunkering. I would love to see when Kevin was hurt in 2013. I worked for David Eager and we had the PGA at. The place across from Oakmont, I forget the name of it, but they took out all the cross bunkerings, destroyed the golf course.
And
Out? Out. Oh. All the cross bunkers are parallel to the fairways. And I told them,
ruined it. That tells you the shot you have to hit, right? I mean, you can tell like what he wants you to do. Like, you have to have those in there. Yeah, that's it.
He gives you options. Do you challenge this bunker? Do you hit him between the bunkers? It's brilliant. You know, that's why, you know, winning last week, I am such a huge military person. I love our military. I love every aspect of it. I mean, there's nothing more in life than to me, you know, than my family, my friends, my golf, and then it's, you know, the people that, the heroes of our country, and that's our military. And to be able to win last week, you know, is just on that golf course of Seth Rayner, CB McDonald. I mean, it's going to go up there as one of my top wins.
Yeah, it's I don't know what was in the water, but
yeah, it's one of Kevin's top wins.
Yes,
not mine.
But what a cool venue to do it on, especially since they it looks like the redo that what's his name came in who specializes in them. It looks good on TV. Like that golf course looks as good as it's ever looked.
Yeah, I even said to Johnson, I said, Johnson, that's the top 100. He says, absolutely. I mean, it's got so many great holes on it. And the bunkering is phenomenal. They really did a great job. You know, I was kind of a little disappointed. They took a lot of the bite out of two of the greens. It kind of tamed them. But with that being said, you know, you can get those greens to 13 or 14 like they did, you know, for Sunday. I mean, they can get the greens as fast as they can. They've got so many great pin placements. So, you know, and that's the reason why they've kind of, you know, softened the greens a little bit. So that now they can get the greens up to 12 or 13, because otherwise you couldn't have had pin placements on some of the greens. So I get it that way. But, it's I so look forward to playing. It's like I'm looking so forward to the PGA so I can go and play St. Louis Country Club.
Well, yeah, and then I think it's going to be, we're getting on a sidebar here, but I mean, you could make Chicago Golf Club, because it's too short, you can't have a, I don't even think you could have a Champions Tour event out there anymore, but you know, for the ladies, it's going to be perfect. We don't have to manipulate the golf course, but man, those first four holes, I mean, if they get tough pin positions and those greens, I'm sure when you play there too, they can get rolling. I mean, they're going to make, that could be one hell of a test, on that golf course.
And you're 100% right. And here's the thing is, it doesn't, you know, everybody's into the yardage. It has to be long. It doesn't have to be long. You know, I don't, no disrespect, but you know, they butchered the U.S. Open this year. You know, they took the fairways and they brought them up out 60% wider than in 2004. And they added 500 yards. They didn't have to widen the golf course. They didn't have to lengthen the golf course. They could have left that golf course just the way it was, and they would have still had the same winning score, or maybe even higher if they had fairways that were still, on average, 27 yards wide like they played in 2007. Or 2004, but they widened the fairways to 42 yards wide. Then they put 500 yards. It's not, the USGA needs to get over their length issue, and everybody else needs to get over their length issue. And it's all about having tighter fairways and longer rough and harder greens with rough around it. And that will dictate the winning score every single week. You don't need a long golf course anymore. You need a tight golf course.
Yeah, you could have Chicago Golf Club play for the senior ladies at 6,100 yards. And like you said, mm-hmm. If you got those green speeds up and those pins tucked, you could have even par win that tournament. You could make the
pins even that. Par if exactly. And you know, and even par probably, you know, unless they soften the golf course up, even par probably will win. You know, it's gonna be very tough for if those greens get hard and fast, it's going to be very tough for the women just to keep the ball on the Redan hole.
And that's a huge Redan, right? I mean, that thing swings, right?
Huge.
I mean, huge. I mean, think of like green one if the pin's on the left-hand side, right? And it's tucked back there. Yeah. I mean, I have a hard time getting to that pin. I mean, I basically take my 50-footer or 40-footer and hope to God I can two-putt it. I mean, that golf, you could be plus three through the first four holes of that golf course before you sneeze.
Exactly, and it just, you know, and that's a very generous fairways. Those fairways are generous. Yeah. If you brought the fairways in, and it was 6,800 from the tips?
No, I don't even think it's that long, like 67, 66 and change. Okay, 64.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously they're not going to do that. You're not going to have a PGA, but they could have a Champions Tour there, easy. A U.S. Open Champions Tour, if they just brought the fairways in to 30 yards wide, you know, they could do it, and not a, and it would be probably one of the best senior opens of all time. But you know, it's it's going to change a little bit of the characteristics of the golf course. And I agree with you that way. But it's just phenomenal. I mean, the brilliance of the design work from those two were just off the charts.
Well, I've got two more quick ones here for you. Then I'll get you out of here. The best two or three stops on the PGA Tour, non-majors, and what makes those tournaments that you and Kevin would go to so great, and why do you like them so much?
Well, number one would be Phoenix Open, hands down. It's a party with a golf tournament going on. It's something that, you know, you deal with. It's once a year. The crowds are phenomenal. If we get good weather, you know, I love it. I love going there. I have friends that come every year to go to the Bird's Nest, and they have the live entertainment there. You know, we just don't get crowds like that. And they've done a better job policing the idiots. But, you know, when you have drinking, it's only one tournament a year. Now, if it was like that every year, yeah, I'd have a problem with it. But that, to me, is a must. If you're a golf fan, you have to go there, and that's why it's up there in my top three. The golf course is average. It's just about the whole atmosphere of the tournament. Scottsdale, a lot of great restaurants. I've got a lot of good friends there. Two would be Pebble Beach, my favorite place in the whole country to go to play golf. I've got great friends that used to live at Lake Nona, Angie and Bob Izzy, that I stayed with And I've got another friend that lives on the 16th hole that Kevin actually stayed with at MPCC. My friends just bought it. They just built a house on the 8th tee box of the Dunes course. So Cypress Point, getting to play there. I played it a handful of times. I didn't get to play it the last couple of years, but it's just there's an energy there at Pebble. Love going down to Carmel and walking on the beach. And then what would it be? You know, I got to think about this.
Is Jack's tournament always up there for the way you guys are treated and the ambiance?
I love the golf course. You know, Jack Nicklaus has always been my favorite. I think he's the greatest of all time. And no disrespect to Tiger Woods, but you know, if Tiger gets to 18 majors, then I'm going to give it to Tiger. But you know, we base everything on majors. So I love Memorial. It would be up there. Colonial would be up there. I would put Bay Hill up there because it's Arnold and I live, you know, at Lake Nona. And I get to sleep in my own bed. You know, there's a lot of great ones. My hometown is Ridgewood Country Club, where we have the first playoff this year. You know, I've got family there. We don't get to go there every year, but that would be one. So I probably got a handful.
Yeah, some good stops there.
Final
one. Best golf shot you ever saw as a caddy in a tournament? So it could be your guy, could be a woman that you were caddying for on the LPGA Tour. Is there one shot that stands out that you were just absolutely blown away at of, I didn't see that, and that player just pulled off something that, holy cow?
That's a great question. I'm so old, I can't remember.
I asked this to some other players, and usually, like, it's a Tiger Woods story, right, where they're like, I did a par five over water, and I never saw that.
Yeah.
And here comes some screaming two iron with a high cut that lands like somebody dropped it, you know, out of the heavens. It's something where they just didn't see it.
Yeah, it's like the shot that he hit at the Canadian Open on 18.
That's come up.
Exactly. But I wasn't there. The best short game shot I think I've ever seen would have been Mickelson. We played with him last year, or it was a year. Wasn't last year, it was 2 years ago when Bones was still working for him, and he hit it over the green on 14, through the fairway into the rough on a downslope, and the pin was tucked front right, and he had nothing. And I mean nothing, but he does have a 64-degree wedge, and he hit it to 5 feet. And it just, I mean, it just blew everybody away. I mean, but it wasn't that he won the golf tournament, so you can't say it was the greatest shot, but it was the greatest short game shot I've ever seen.
Right, well, and you see a lot of great golf, right? I mean, and all of a sudden, if you see a shot that you don't normally see, I mean, you're dealing with the best players in the world, when somebody does something like that, and that gets your attention, that's got to be pretty crazy, because you see good golf, great golf all the time.
Right, yeah. And you know what, you I guess when you see it all the time, you kind of like, wow, that was pretty cool, you know? That was an amazing shot. I wish I had one.
Well, I think Phil 50 yards over a green hitting it to 5 feet, assuming he made the putt. That's a pretty good up and down
there. He did make the putt, and I thought honestly, he was dead. I mean, anybody else under those circumstances couldn't have even gone at the flag. Now that's what I mean. Couldn't even gone at the flag. They'd have gone 30 feet right of it, because they would have, because if he hit it too far, he hits it down the hill. If he didn't hit it far enough, then he was dead even more. I mean, and he hit it like it was, you know, something he does every day. That's what was so amazing. And he does do that every day, because that's why he carries a 64-degree wedge. Yeah, I was in awe, but, you know, that was recently. And I'm sure there's been shots that just been like, are you kidding me? But I just can't remember right now. So I guess they weren't that simple.
Yeah. I think the Phil shot fits the bill for that. Of if somebody can hit it from that kind of a lie to that close and get up and down, that's why he's Phil Mickelson. That's why he's in the Hall of Fame. So,
and that's the reason why I said to Bones. I said, man, you are so blessed to be able to watch that short game every day. And I did say that to him. I said, man, you're blessed to be able to see. Yeah, because I mean, that is the shot, because that's the one that comes to me.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, like I said, as much good golf, great golf as you see, for that to just pop into your brain, that's out of the ordinary great. Well, and I want to thank you so much for your time, and it's cool to watch the journey you and Kevin are on. I'm a fan of you guys, and I know we were talking for a while of, you know, getting you on the podcast, but this worked out perfect, especially after a victory. So tell Kevin congratulations from us as well, and keep the momentum going this summer, and hopefully we can get you on here soon after maybe like a major victory this year would be kind of nice with the trend line. So keep playing well, and thanks for your time. I really, really appreciate it, Kenny.
Thanks, Jason. Have a great one. Appreciate you.